business of culture, the culture of business, markets, policy, media, and technology, misfits, marketing, what else? Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad.
He talked to and realized it's the same thing going on in our industry, that there are talented people who don't get a shot, or there are talented people who do get a shot who are in the business who maybe weren't trained like the majority, or there are people in high school and college who don't even know that advertising is a potential career. So Creative Ladder was put together to help those groups, those people of color who maybe didn't come up in the way that the majority did and need training. There are people who are in college who are making career choices, or at least who don't know that advertising is a potential path.
Danny Robinson, the new CEO of award-winning ad shop The Martin Agency, on staying competitive, omnivorous, and funky amid big media's inexorable decline. Stay with us. Full Disclosure Podcast to NPR, Spotify, and of course, Apple Podcasts. The link is fulldradio.com. You can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at handle fulldradio. And a shout out to our listeners on WVTF Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news station. You can DM me to carry Full Disclosure on your air. Joining me in the heart of Shaco Slip, Richmond, Virginia, actually where this show started in May of 2014, is Danny Robinson, the new CEO of the Martin Agency, the award-winning ad agency under the Inter-Republic Group. Danny started here nearly 20 years ago. I think it was in 2004. He is nearly a 40-year veteran of the advertising industry. Sir, how are you?
I am great, thank you.
You know, in all my time dealing with the creative co-conspirators here, I never got to meet you or shake your hand. I guess you were, you know, behind the scenes.
Yeah, my entire career worked really hard to lay as low as possible, fly under the radar.
I always have mixed feelings when I'm here in Shaco Slip because, I mean, to people listening outside or not familiar with Richmond, this is where my show started. This is a gorgeous cobblestone district, but we're also literally a stone's throw from where there was tremendous human suffering in the 19th century and before. I'm talking about the slave docks in Manchester. I'm talking about the Devil's Half Acre, the slave jails nearby. It's always, you know, a lot of this was clearly whitewashed in the Lost Cause period. There was a big fire at the end of the Civil War. But I'm always reminded of it because this was my inception. This is where it started. And here you are, a person of color who's the CEO of an agency where I imagine when you started, there was not a lot of color.
Not a lot, no. It's, I came here in 2004. There were a handful, I guess when I got here, I'm not even sure that there were any creatives of color, at least not black. There were a handful along the way, very few in senior leadership positions. A couple, Keith Cartwright was here, who went off and started his own agency. But no, as I often am, the only one in the room.
Had this discussion in parallel on Wall Street in consulting circles. There's a lot of lip service paid to it. You're not getting a lot of diversity of thought. From an investing background, I know this is neither here nor there. You always wanted to invest in as many assets as possible to get the best risk-adjusted return. And I think that also when in the magazine world, we found when there was not diversity in the room, when there was not differing of opinions, people could call out certain campaigns and everything. It would look, there was a bigger risk of it hitting with the splatter afterwards when you did not have antipodal voices. Mm-hmm. There's something about that kind of as a through line to this show.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for a long time. And if you believe research, which people do when it's convenient, diversity in all industries makes every industry better. You can see it when you talk about airline industry, aeronautics industry, medicine. There are enough studies to show that when there are diverse populations in teams, that those teams outperform other teams. But you would think that'd be enough. And you would think, because that often leads to profitability, depending on the industry, you think that would be enough for it to change. But it is a really difficult system to break. And I do understand often it's certainly easier to, when you're hiring even, when you look out and you see the people you might consider probably went to school similar to yours or probably live someplace near you or at least look like you. And I understand that it is, if you don't work at it, it's a very easy default.
If you're interviewing a really promising college or grad school student or a non-traditional person who wasn't at college, there is this temptation, also having been in recruiting before, to bring in that person who makes you feel comfortable, who's congruent with your style, your thoughts and everything, doesn't make you feel uncomfortable, which a professional, a person now, in addition to being a creative and you're a CEO in a very disrupted industry, it's a hard discipline to welcome voices of dissent, a person that's going to call you out on the creative room or on the whiteboarding room. It's inconvenient, but businesses know, as investors know, the diversification. I know I'm wonking out. I mean, the only free lunch, they say, in investing is if you could theoretically own every asset in the world at the lowest possible price, and certain things zig when others zag, and you get the best risk-adjusted return. Mm-hmm. And yet people are at companies and they love their companies and they want to have their entire retirement in the stock.
Yes.
And so I know this is a strange way of bringing it back to a broader conversation about, you know, especially in creativity and in a hugely disrupted industry right now, how do you bring in different voices who are not, you know, cut from the same cloth, who didn't go to the prep schools, who didn't, you know, work on the same, whatever is left of Madison Avenue track to get here?
Well, the way you do it is to commit to doing it. Every time I'm asked the question, how do you change it? I just say, well, you just change it. Because the people who are in charge of making it change could make the decision to do just that. Could say, I'm not going to go look in the same places I always look for talent. Could say, I'm going to invest in talent that is atypical to the industry, which means investing in their training often, because if you're not coming from a brand center or a school that teaches advertising, you are more than likely behind. And that requires more people's time and more money, but it can be done. It is interesting in an industry that is creatively led, where if you start listing the creative minds that people know and respect and admire and have done things, you know, those are the ones that break the mold, that are dissenting voices in the room, that are the Steve Jobs of the world who take another path. You hear the list of people who are in Silicon Valley who dropped out of college because they had an idea to do something different. So the answer has always been to commit to doing it and then doing it. Easy to say, apparently difficult to do, and difficult to do because it comes with risk, I think.
Is there a tug of war kind of for you spiritually and within the industry between creatives and managers, operators? You have parent companies and, you know, various agencies are repatriating profits to them. It's an enormously disrupted time of cable cord cutting. Mm-hmm. Magazines barely exist anymore, newspapers and the other. Is there a part of you that just wants to be the creative, wants to be that iconoclast, but not want to manage people?
It is a absolute tug of war for creatives who get into a business at 20-something to want to make things.
Yeah.
I don't want to break things. I want to put their voice out into the world, who, if they are successful, continue to climb a ladder and get promoted and get to a point where, oh, you've done really well. Now it's time for you to manage. And I'm sure they look around and go, first of all, nobody's taught me how to manage anybody. Secondly, that's not why I got into the business, because the further you climb, the further away you get from the actual work and the making of the work. And that is a struggle for creatives. There's some intersection where they've been very successful and now it's time to be promoted to a place where you are now leading people. We've had people here and there was a philosophy, and kind of still holds true. Mike Hughes, who was the chief creative officer when I started here and before, there were people here who he just said they don't want to be managers, but they are incredibly valuable writers and art directors. And we're going to keep increasing their salary, but they're going to hold this title. And they're not going to be managers. They're just going to work, and they're going to make great work for us. And it's an interesting philosophy. You can't have everyone do that. Everyone can't stay at an art director level, get paid like a most senior person, and not manage anyone. That doesn't work. But it was an interesting philosophy to me when we were small enough to be able to do it, because he knew that the talent was the most important thing and that he could probably find enough people who could manage as well. It is a weird thing, and very few creatives are taught how to be managers, because that's not the job.
Yeah.
At least not at the inception.
Explain for our listeners who are familiar with the show that we occasionally revisit marketing and advertising and what's happened to the chief marketing officer role. I think there was a Wall Street Journal piece about that last year. Mm-hmm. In this time of grand fragmentation. I mean, right now, if you're a celebrity, one of the premium hits is to be on Hot Ones eating hot wings and talking about your book or your concert, because the virality on YouTube is massive. Whereas maybe 15 years ago, it was a Today Show or Larry King and others. And yet that is a really fragmented opportunity. This is a long-winded way of me asking you, what happened to the old model, the agency of record? I'm thinking people who watch Mad Men, you know, 20 years ago are thinking a big Fortune 500 company comes in and they want the big soup to nuts engagement with you. You take care of marketing, lead gen, you do digital, you do print, you do TV. My impression is that that is a an endangered fish.
It is, for a lot of reasons. The fragmentation of media, the breaking apart of agencies, media being pulled out of agencies to having sitting in another place, things being siloed, specialty agencies who just do social and sometimes just do digital specific, compounded with the fact that those marketing managers don't stay in jobs as long as they used to. So the idea of an agency of record, of some marketing manager at a big company hiring an agency for 5-10 years when they used to stay at that company for 5 or 10 years. Now their tenure is 3 years if they're lucky.
Sure.
So why put all your eggs in one basket? And it's also more efficient on the business side, or i.e. cheaper, to do project-based work, to not have the big contracts.
To kind of be mercenary and go in a la carte.
Yes. And, you know, there was a time where we were paid on... The model has completely changed for the factors. A bunch of factors have contributed to the change in model. The days of agency of record are numbered.
Yeah, is Madison Avenue dead effectively? Well, I mean, there are no agencies on Madison Avenue. An agency of record.
We have a few, but we see the writing that you're working year to year, project to project. We love agency of record, and it's because we believe in the power of building a brand over time. The pressure for marketing managers is to build sales immediately. And there is no overtime because I'm not going to be there long enough to even see the fruits of my labor 5 years from now. If I'm lucky, I'm here for the next 2 or 3 years. And there's quarterly pressure, street earnings pressures. Yeah. It's harder. And it makes it harder for us to build anything. We have to work really hard to build quickly now. And if you're thinking about building a brand like Geico, that we've had for 30 plus years, or a brand like Snickers or a brand like Nike, where the brand has been built over time with one agency, that's much harder to do now. Much harder.
Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad. We are joined by Danny Robinson, the new CEO of the Martin Agency. He's been here for the better part of 20 years and in the advertising industry for closer to 40 years. I guess you were chief creative officer before that, and Kristen Cavallo, your predecessor as CEO, really asserted in the publicity coming out that the creatives are in control here. It's not the bean counters. I don't know if it's so zero sum that you have these eras, this tug of war between the people managing the decline versus the true north of creativity. Make it great, make it creative, make it funky, and the business will come to you, whatever the business becomes.
Yeah, well, it is. It's maybe wrong to assume that a creative can't think business-mindedly, in the same way that it's a bad assumption that a marketing manager or a CEO can't think creatively. But Kristen is very clear. We're in the business of creativity. Why wouldn't you want a creative to be the leader of that business?
This has been a year of hell for big media conglomerates. You look at Warner Brothers, Discovery, Disney, clearly Paramount, which is looking for a buyer. Paramount owns CBS, which is kind of a true north, a lot of sports assets. But, you know, brands like Nickelodeon and MTV, which used to drive the conversation, but the cable cord cutting has just unbelievable amounts of people leaving TV and becoming, especially if you talk to my kids, my younger kids, they go straight to YouTube, where it's just much harder and much more fragmented. So you might have the great ideas, but you're hustling. Like, do we have to have a TikTok strategy? Do we need to be on Instagram? Do we have to have a portfolio of influencers? Do we have to have celebrity adjacency? Suddenly table stakes is, you know, big celebrities have to have a podcast. I don't know how you put your head on a pillow at night and sleep with, you know, forgive me, with job security, thinking about all that.
Well, the answer to the question is yes, you need to have that, all of that and more. And it's obviously brand specific, but yes, the thing that allows me to sleep, I think, is that all of those things are also opportunity for us. The channels used to be really clear and small in number. TV, print, out of home, radio. That's about it.
Yeah.
Every once in a while you might do a stunt, and they were called stunts because that's what they really were. Now it is the opportunity to create, and the media and the places to put things it's not infinite, but it certainly is a lot broader than when I started. So an optimist might say, that's great. That means there are other ways for us to use creativity to solve business problems if we can find the audience that we need to find and talk to them in the place where they are seeking information, as opposed to interrupting the thing that they were looking at, like watching television and putting a commercial in front of them. You could say that, well, if we're in the right place on TikTok, on Instagram, and they're actually seeking us out, which is why we made Martin Entertainment, we need to be as entertaining as the content that they are seeking out on their own.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that because YouTube is a colossus. I think Google paid $2.6 billion for it.
What a bargain.
What a bargain. And then now it becomes, as a guest we recently had on said, it was a never-ending video jukebox out there. I mean, it knows how to feed you, and you could call it. There's no real analog to it. There's the biggest cable channel ever known to man. But I have never really wanted to watch an ad. Everybody looks for the skip, the 5-second button, and it's like we're going through the motions of doing this. And there was a great golden age of streaming where suddenly you were getting Disney Plus and others without the ad experience, and getting it for a low clip, and you got used to being able to binge and watch without advertising. So also don't want to be subversive. You don't want to kind of fool people like, look, the ads are coming in here. But if they can come to something in entertainment and legitimately find curation and, I don't know, celebrity adjacency, you're accomplishing a lot under one roof.
Those streaming days of no ads are good luck looking finding that.
No, Netflix is doubling down on advertising. All of them are pushing through the ad tier.
Yeah.
And they're still losing money.
Yes. And the opportunity again is, if you're going to be advertising on Netflix, you better find a way to entertain. You better have your message be entertaining, which is, again, I think that's an opportunity. It's one of the reasons we created Martin Entertainment. We saw that coming. We hired Alana Strauss, who used to work at Netflix and then at Fender. And she knows what it takes to be a part of the Netflix family. She knows that we need to have entertainment. It is still, it's commercials again. That no one's going to be calling it that.
Right.
But it is advertising during content. Our content has to, strongly believe our content has to be as entertaining as the content that the people are seeking out. And Netflix is probably a great place to test that model out. They're not going to be happy at first, and then they'll be fine. Because
is there a place that you've seen it that was not done in this shop that you said, yes, that's it? I'll give you my example,
yes.
For example. The Daft Punk album that came out in 2013, Random Access Memories, Sony commissioned a pre-doc of the backstories of every track on YouTube. And so Giorgio Moroder was interviewed. There was the guy who did Piano, the guys who were approached, the backstory, Panda Bear, and others who were approached by these mysterious two Daft Punk robots from France.
Yes.
And before you even heard of the song, they were leaving you little crumbs. And Sony was just behind the scenes. It had the thing at the very outset. And I was already anticipating that album, but that made me feel super jazzed that I knew the kind of, even before Song Exploder or anything.
Right.
And so, yeah, Sony was there behind the scenes. It didn't need to hit me over the head with a Walkman or an LCD TV or anything. And I was like, all right, this is how it's done. And that was already way back, 11 years ago.
And how many people did you tell about it?
Everybody.
Yeah.
I kept sending it around. I was like, wow. The backstory of, like, Giorgio Moroder was one of the founding fathers of disco.
Mm-hmm.
And to be approached by these guys saying, we want to do this song. And them saying, we don't even know how this is going to end up, but you're so flattered that the guys from France would summon you over and just keep, sampling stuff and everything. And the reveal to them was just as fascinating as it was to you.
Yeah.
And I realized that I was doing Sony's marketing on behalf of them.
That's a great example. And relevant to you, because I get a sense that music is part of who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you told...
Music makes me lose control. Sorry. I have to put a lyric into everything.
Let's go. That's a great example. That's an example of being relevant to you.
Yeah.
You telling everyone you know is an example of you being a micro-influencer, maybe without even thinking that you are.
I'm just a suburban dad.
Yeah, sure.
With a podcast mic. Anyway, go ahead.
But that's what we're that's what I'm talking about. That's what that was selling. It wasn't selling you. It was entertaining you. A product they wanted you to eventually buy. But in a way that did not feel like either an ad or an interruption.
Like, what was the genesis of that? Was it an agency of record that went to Sony Records and said, "We want to do this"? The Daft Punk robots weren't in it. It was somebody interviewing. I'll send
still
it to you.
Still sounds like the creative minds of the Daft
Punk. Of the Daft Punk people. Yeah. And then something else happened in parallel at this very agency that was really formative for me. And I wish that we had pounced on it. One of your or two of your creatives, I don't know if it was a marijuana moment or something. They got around in a circle in 2014 and said, Foo Fighters haven't been here in 16 years, whatever it was, and then everything. And they challenged Dave Grohl and the Foo Fighters to come to this. You remember this story?
Oh, yeah, I was here.
This notional concert at the National, and then it happened. And the people that attended and put the money in escrow to go to this concert that didn't just exist, Dave Grohl looks at it and says, yeah, you know what? I'll do it. He lives in Northern Virginia and everything. And everybody loved that night. And now it's like fabled. You hear stories about it. The people are like, if you just knew what came together that night, how intimate it was. And I wish that the world had covered that better. I wish that Richmond and Rolling Stone and everybody was there to say, this was the true, the first true A-list on-demand concert in history that cut out Ticketmaster and the others.
Yeah, just some people who like Foo Fighters who wanted to see them.
Some real fans with agency that wanted to see them to see them intimately. And there was a documentary about it, but then it kind of came, you know, had it been used to its max, maybe they would have had him on point at the end of that concert and said, all right, Dave, who do you dare to come on next? Like kind of like an ice bucket challenge. But I was thinking about that at that point. I mean, what was an incentive for a band that makes a ton of money on merch and touring and everything to come and do a 1,500 show venue in Richmond, Virginia? But they knew that that would have meant so much to fans, and the multiplier effect of it. And the donut salesman guy, the guy Sugar Shack, who was just starting up, showed up with a bunch of boxes, and Dave Grohl Instagrammed it. And that was, in the infancy of this show, that was really eye-opening to me.
Yeah, that was the right band, too. Dave Grohl was the right guy, too.
How would you know?
Well, if you know them, because Kiss would not have shown up.
Yeah.
For example, I think the Foo Fighters was the right band, and Dave was the right guy to do something like that. But you're right. If and maybe this, I'm not sure this is good or bad.
Yeah.
If the same idea came up today, there would have been more attached to it, because the team would have thought, okay, we'll do this, and what else will be a part of it? Like you said, they would, let's have Dave ask for the next band to come. Let's do something. Let's find a brand.
It would have been more premeditation to it.
Yeah, a lot more. That was just pure love for a band and a couple of people who said, let's see if this works. Without a brand attached to it, without a client attached to it, it may be its purest form in 2014, and would have been maybe not as pure in,
it can happen again today.
Yeah. So it's probably good that it happened then. A missed opportunity for something else, but it's probably really good that it happened then in the way that it happened.
So when the question I have, the difficult question always we've asked, is it must totally harsh your mellow when an executive, be it a CMO or whatever committee's replaced that CMO, talks about the ROI of a campaign. You could talk about impact. You could talk about page views. You could talk about impressions. You could bring all sorts of soft metrics. But if they say, whatever, on a $5 million buy, I've not seen incremental revenue on this. It's hard to get them to keep the faith when they have quarterly financials and the sword is hanging above them.
It really does depend on, I mean, which is why we asked, what are the KPIs for this thing?
Key performance
index. We need to know, or indicator. We need to know, what do you want this thing to do? If you want it to return $2 on a dollar investment, we need to think about what it is we're making. If you want awareness to be the thing, we have to think about what it is we're making. If we have metrics for UPS, for example, we know what they expect each of the pieces of work to do, including the work that they expect in a return, a financial return. But some of the metrics are more soft. Some of them are, we just want to be more relevant. We want to be considered more innovative. It does depend, and we need to know up front what it is they want the work to do, because if we just make something and we put it out into the world, and then the question is, well, where is the return on my dollar? You didn't say that that's what you wanted this thing to do. This thing was created to build brand awareness. And if you look at those metrics, it did exactly that. But the pressure is going to be increasingly on the, what am I getting in return? What is the dollar return? Budgets are shrinking, and CMOs are being expected to return quarterly. And those things are happening, and the pressures are coming. But that's not always the need for some brands. Some brands need different things to happen. And it isn't an either or, because sometimes it's, we need a return on a dollar here, but we also need to build relevance at the same time. So different pieces of communication do different things.
Are you a student of how things like, I mean, this goes back to Malcolm Gladwell's books and Tipping Points, how something like Stanley cups came out of nowhere.
God, you don't want to.
No,
get
my
me
daughter badgers
on Stanley
me about
cups.
It, but these were like, you know, workaday soup, lunch pail type things, and then they became the hottest. You could not have premeditated that last year. You guys could not have gotten around in a circle or gone out for drinks and said, "Let's bring back Stanley," like, you know, Dickies, or these things just happen in a vacuum almost.
Yes, they do, and I have a feeling about Stanley cups. They do. You can't manufacture things like that. We do work hard to manufacture fame or manufacture success, which we have a culture impact lab is a department we built to help. They're PR experts or social experts to influencer experts to help manufacture our work so that when it gets out into the world, there's a higher likelihood of it catching on and catching fire. Things like Stanley Cup, good for Stanley.
I don't even know what the parent company is. Is it Coleman? I don't even know.
I don't know.
I mean, it's such a small layer, but these are massively profitable. They're being hoarded. There's a Target version of it that was pink or Starbucks. Like, I could not have premeditated that.
And the question is, 2025, is there going to be Stanley Cups? I listened to the Kristen Cavallo podcast, and you asked her about LaCroix or LaCroix at the time.
Wow, to think.
It's the same, except that that's sustained. But it's the same. Nobody would have guessed that another sparkling bubbly water was going to become that thing because there were hundreds of sparkling bubbly waters. Those things you can't manufacture. And the next thing that's going to happen, you're not going to be able to know and manufacture or see coming. And that's one of the things that usually happens really fast and often burns out really quickly. So we'll see. We'll a year from now, ask someone about Stanley Cups and let's see where it is.
Sure.
If there is such a thing.
Let me type that into my BlackBerry Pearl. Full disclosure, stay with us. Full disclosure podcast to NPR, Spotify, all the fine podcatchers, including and especially Apple Podcasts. Whatever you prefer to use, Podtopia, I don't even know what they're called anymore. The link, it has every podcatcher, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. Please leave a review, tell your mother-in-law, call your girlfriend, whatever you need to do. We are on all the socials at handle fulldradio, and my DMs are always open. If you're just joining us, I'm in downtown Richmond in the heart of Shaco Slip with the new CEO of advertising giant, the Martin Agency, Danny Robinson, the AdWake Agency of the Year in 2020 and 2021, and Ad Age Agency of the Year in 2023. Since he stepped into the role of Chief Creative Officer previously, it says that you have a track record of pushing the industry forward through your efforts in the DEI space. I saw as a footnote, you sit on the board of, what is it, Creative Ladder? It's a nonprofit founded by Ryan Reynolds that increases the accessibility of creative careers for people of all backgrounds.
Yes.
Does that guy strike out? I mean, every week I see that he has a new IPO, a new company, you know, selling, I don't know, Mint Mobile or some finance thing. I mean, in addition to being an absolute A-lister and married to a goddess, does anything go wrong for this guy?
Not publicly. He's a smart, incredibly charming, talented guy. And it started with what he saw happening on movie sets. So they were behind the lens and often in front of the lens, but behind the lens in particular. He didn't see people. Everyone looked the same, mostly white males, some white females. But he wondered, where are the people of color? Where are the underrepresented talent behind the camera? And he has a friend who is in the advertising business or who was, who he talked to and realized it's the same thing going on in our industry, that there are talented people who don't get a shot, or there are talented people who do get a shot who are in the business who maybe weren't trained like the majority, or there are people in high school and college who don't even know that advertising is a potential career.
Sure.
So there are kind of three groups of people. So Creative Ladder was put together to help those groups, those people of color who have jobs already but maybe didn't come up in the way that the majority did and need training. There are people who are in college who are making career choices, or at least maybe not career choices, but picking majors, who don't know that advertising is a potential path. And then there are kids in high school who have no role models, who don't know that they know advertising. They're living on TikTok. They are part of what it is we do, but don't know that that's a potential career. So it was designed to help those three groups get smarter about the business, with the idea that we need to fill a pipeline with people who are just different than the the industry looks.
And I see that before you were at the Martin Agency, I love saying, because it makes me seem so wise, at the turn of the century.
Oh, God.
Robinson
makes you seem so old.
Was co-founder of Vigilante, the cultural insights-driven creative shop behind the famous Oprah Winfrey Pontiac giveaway. You get a car, you get a car, you get a car. And the pop quiz quickly for you is, who spoofed that on SNL?
Maya Rudolph.
And hold that thought, because we're going to come back to her. Now that that actually, so you talk about you get a car, you get a car. What about companies going directly, making the beeline to the celebrity influencer to get someone? We've had even kind of mom and pop type influencers who are in a niche, who have a really cute child, who somebody will give them a lot of merch and, you know, say in your Instagram reel that this made my life easy and my child loves these and he's great and he's never colicky. But then there are others where they'll go directly to a Kim Kardashian or a Travis Kelce or Travis Kelce's wife, who's been getting all sorts of
engagements. He's not married, is he?
I'm sorry, the other Kelce.
Oh.
The brother, Jason Kelce?
Jason.
I lost track.
That's
okay.
And they
have a hit podcast, too.
Yes, they do.
Right?
Yes.
But both of them get all these overtures that I don't know if that's, who is doing that behind the scenes, acting as agent between the corporation and the celebrity?
I mean, there are agencies built to do that. It is unlikely that brands are going directly to celebrities. It's more likely that they're going to agencies that are set up to who manage those celebrities.
And what happens behind the scenes? Is there a discussion of culture? I mean, I didn't know this about Ryan Reynolds. Ryan Reynolds is a person of tremendous clout and agency. VCs can go to him.
Mm-hmm. And they do.
Yeah, they do. There are investors that actually go, who's the guy who won the an Oscar for playing a transgender person in Dallas Buyers Club? Jared Leto.
Yes, Jared Leto.
He is a tech investor. He is a tech angel investor. I mean, there's a backstory to all of this, that if you knew kind of the backdoor channel to people and what enchants them, is the agency really doing that? Or are there other specialists who bring brands into proximity with
primarily specialists? I mean, even when we have ideas for celebrities, we need to, we don't reach out to them. We reach out to their managers, or we reach out to agencies that handle celebrities. So I don't know what I know a lot of money talk goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
I know most of them. There is the expectation now that that is part of the revenue stream for celebrities.
That's
it's
incredible.
Funny that at the turn of the century, as you say, when we started Vigilante, that was still a time where it was considered selling out if a celebrity started talking brands. Celebrities that typically didn't, like musicians. I mean, you remember,
or some would go to Japan to do it.
Yeah,
there was a website called
Japander. The fragrance commercials overseas uses the A-list U.S. celebrities would never see over here.
Sure.
And I guess the money is a whole lot bigger.
Yeah.
And maybe they figure nobody's going to see that, and they'll still have
it's like offshoring.
Yes, right. They'll still have who they are here, but there'll be something somewhere else where nobody here will see them. I mean, you remember when the Who or the Stones, the Rolling Stones, you start me up, or Microsoft start me up for
launch
of. It was a big deal. Now celebrities don't bat. No.
And then a few years after that, Sheridan tried to do a reboot, and they said, let's spend the night to...
Nobody cared.
And now it's, you know, now it's everywhere. I mean, Nick Drake was used. The late Nick Drake was used in a Volkswagen ad.
It doesn't
matter.
And
I wonder
anymore.
I guess it doesn't.
It really doesn't. They don't... the money is... Once the dam broke, and once enough people did it, it's part of the portfolio at this point. It's like, what can I sell? There's still some with integrity. I'm not saying that everyone's giving away everything, but they certainly don't question whether they should do it. I think at this point, it's who should I do it with and how much are they going to pay
Sometimes me? I think parenthetically in thought bubbles, and forgive me for this, but I'm watching these promos for the next season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I think is the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And on Insta, these guys are Larry's leaving the golf game with his pal, and they see Lori Loughlin. With her Porsche,
yes.
And it's got handicap plates on it. They're like, what? She's like, what? And they mentioned this, you know, this amorphous syndrome and everything.
Uh-huh.
You have that syndrome, right? She's like, what? It's like, yeah, I guess I do have that. And so she's clearly riffing on her own. And I guess you have to own it, kind of like Martha Stewart did.
Yes.
With her dalliance in prison and others and rehabilitation coming out. But I guess it's a send up on selling out in general. She sold out. She lost her authenticity, but maybe she's rehabilitated enough to go back onto the Hallmark channel or something.
Yeah, well, maybe not the Hallmark channel.
But I want to take it back to you. authentic.
I've been working hard to keep it off of me, but
Danny,
come on.
But this is that we typically do it with the show now. And again, we started here 10 years ago. I mean, this is sacred ground for me because May 1st, 2014 was our first show.
Yeah.
And you had a vestigial audio recording studio. I mean, it didn't have anything like this back then. It was called Running with Scissors.
Yes.
Where did you grow up? Where did you start off? How did this happen?
I was born an hour and 45 minutes east of here. I never know which direction it is. In Hampton, Virginia, which is from here. Most people on the way to Virginia Beach in between. Born and raised on a college campus, historically black college, Hampton. Then it was called Hampton Institute. Now it's Hampton University.
We had Rashida Jones from MSNBC on the show. And a bunch of sorority sisters came and greeted her in November. Her story started at Hampton, yeah.
Yes, I was born on the campus. I was my father was a professor. My father taught college. My mother taught kindergarten and first grade. So I was raised surrounded by black 18 to 22-year-olds my entire life. They were always the same age as I grew up. And went to school there. I thought as I was growing up, there's no way I'm going to go to school here. I live here. I was born here. I'm going to go away and go to school. I got old enough to realize, well, no, this is exactly the place I should go. So I went to school there, undergrad, studied. I was going to get my degree in art education, or got my degree in art education. Thought I was going to teach art in college. As I grew up a painter. I'm still a painter.
You're quite a painter. If you go to your Instagram, but just plug the handle quickly. I want people to see the body of work.
Yeah, it is art, A-R-T. 33.
It's beautiful stuff. I see you blushing about it.
And,
but
yeah, well, I'm embarrassed about everything I do.
You're a Renaissance
man. It's Art 36 and the number 30 and ART30SIX. So I thought I was going to teach college. I student taught my senior year and realized teaching is maybe the hardest job on the face of the earth. I was teaching kids in fifth, sixth grade and kindergarten and high school. And I'd come home every day. And like my mother was a teacher. I remember saying, I really didn't know how hard the job you have is. Thought I'm not sure I can do this for 30 years, but I set my sights on it. And I took an advertising class in my senior year. Like I had no other classes I had to take. I took advertising and marketing and opened my eyes a little bit, was interested in it, decided to get my MBA. Cause I thought marketing would be a thing I could use my skills, creative skills, at least as a marketer.
Was someone mentoring you? I remember how hungry I was for guidance back then. I was completely lost.
No, I had, I didn't know anybody who did any of the things I was interested in. I didn't know anyone who was, I had a high school art teacher that transformed me. I mean, that was probably the most important figure outside of my parents that made me realize who I was and who I could be and pushed me to paint. But I didn't know anybody in marketing. I didn't know anybody in advertising. I knew doctors. One of the benefits of growing up where I grew up, I had my doctor was black, my dentist was black, our lawyers were black. I knew those jobs. I knew what a teacher looked like. But I had no idea what advertising was or a marketer was, but just got enamored with what I learned in class and thought, maybe that's a thing I could do. I seemed to be pretty good at it in class anyway. Advertising was interesting to me. It always was as a kid. I tell anyone I'll go toe-to-toe with you on any jingle from 1960 to 1980 because I spent my childhood
extra
in front of it.
Extra value is what you get.
When you shoot, you're going to – I'll get that. I'll come back to that.
By Coronet. It's Rosemary Clooney.
Gosh, I know that one. I said 60s. That was 50s.
That was 1979. I came to this country.
Was it really?
Extra value is what you get when you buy Coronet.
Okay.
So, darn, I didn't mean to stump you.
Yeah, well, you stumped me. I should have gone.
Take me away.
Anyway, go ahead. That I know. So I between my love for television.
I'm sorry, you can leave now.
No, it's fine. We have another 5 hours
please.
Here. So I said, well, let me see where this takes me. So I went to grad school. And said, apparently you need to get an MBA to do this. So I went to grad school and got my MBA and then set my sights on a specific job working for General Foods then, which is now Altria, I guess.
Was when they were bought by?
They were General Foods. Then they were.
Was acquired by the tobacco company, Philip Morris.
Yeah, Philip Morris, wow. Altria. But still General Foods then. I set my sights on a job working at that company. I got a job working in the post division on cereal.
The cereals. What did you think you were going to do? You thought you were going to mock up
I didn't know what I was going to
do. The artistic stuff. Well,
I thought the idea of marketing was going to be an understanding of brands and building brands. And actually, I was wrong. I mean, at some point, that's what you do after you're there for 5, 6, 7 years. When you're entry level, you're spending a lot of time with numbers and looking at inventory numbers every week and putting together decks.
So
and
people might romance that they're in a writer's room and yucking it up.
That is not
and
what
burning the midnight oil, making creative great stuff in their 20s. But that's not what the ad industry is?
No, this was marketing. This was brand side. I wasn't in advertising yet. I got my MBA to work on the marketing side.
Yeah,
I had a vision of some of that on the brand side, on the client side. There's not a lot of that on the client side. And I realize now 10% of what our clients think about is what we do. 90%, 80%, they got a lot of other stuff they got to worry about, which is, I will keep in perspective how passionate we are about what we do and how important it is to our clients, but how much more they are thinking about finances, inventory, manufacturing. There's a whole bunch of stuff that I realize I'm not interested in. So this job on the market, on the brand side, on the client side, is not going to be good for me for the rest of my career. And I also wasn't particularly good at it. And I found that out the day I was fired. And I'm not sure whether I wasn't good because I wasn't interested or I wasn't good. But that firing pushed me into advertising because what I did know I was pretty good at. And my boss has said, the thing you're really good at is when the ad agency comes in.
Mm.
And you're sitting on the other side of the table and talking to them about advertising and talking to them about packaging.
Part of you was like, take me with you.
I said, I could do that. It's certainly better than I can do what I'm doing now. So I left to do that. And that's how I started in advertising.
What was your first ad shop? Which city?
I got hired. It's very fuzzy to me because it was getting fired was after 2 years working was kind of messed my mind up a bit. I got hired by an ad agency, and I don't remember which because I didn't take the job. I think it was either BBDO or Ogilvy Gabe offered me a job.
To come to New York?
I was already in New York. I was General Foods. Yeah, I was already in New York. But I didn't take it because of the owner of one of the promotion agencies we work with, smaller agency, found out that I was leaving and wanted me to come help him build his department. Fairly small shop in Pleasantville, New York. I was living in Stamford. Pleasantville's in between Stamford and Manhattan. He wanted me to help him build his creative department, and he wanted to move out of the promotion business and more into advertising. I said, well, and he offered me the same amount of money I was making on the client side as opposed to the 50% pay cut I was going to have to take to go to New York and work in advertising. I said, well, maybe I should try this to see if I'm even any good at it. So I took that job, and I spent 12 years with him helping build that company, help him hire creatives.
Going from Connecticut to Westchester?
Yeah, it's easy.
On the Metro North?
No, I drove.
You drove.
Yeah. It's Pleasantville.
Yeah.
And Stanford. It's almost as long to get to the train station as it is in Stanford to get to Pleasantville. I did that job for 12 years, and we slowly got some advertising brands. And
was this in the 1980s?
Yeah.
So this was in the heyday of print magazines that were fat, People Magazine, Money Magazine, TV. There was no cord cutting. There was no internet to speak of.
No internet at all.
What would a dream engagement be like? I mean, was it a lot of people, the only familiarity they have is Don Draper and Mad Men.
Yeah.
You know, the Kodak. The carousel. Polaroid carousel.
Yeah. Well, look, the truth is I wasn't in the advertising business per se. I wasn't on Madison Avenue. I wasn't doing that kind of work. I mean, an entrepreneur with a really profitable business that had some pretty big clients, and the biggest clients were at General Foods. We had Maxwell House, for example. He had some of the brands I worked on the client side. I was working on at his shop.
But I have a jingle in my head that's not Maxwell House. Celebrate the moments of your life. Is that international something?
International,
the little box powders?
Yeah, General Foods International Coffees.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, we had that.
I'm sorry for the PTSD.
It's okay.
But
it's all right.
You guys did this.
As long as
you put this into my Saturday morning cartoons.
I get it right. And someone's going to listen to this and say, no, that's not what it was. It was something else.
It sounds about right.
I wasn't in the business. And I knew that. And I was okay with it because I was really happy.
Were you getting lots of calls from headhunters?
No, nobody knew who I was.
So you're just hanging low still in Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
There's this big center of gravity in New York, and Madison Avenue is still in its prime.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going about what you're doing for 12 years.
Yeah. it was good. It was, I was learning things. I was helping them build the company. I was having fun. We were doing okay work. I mean, in the genre, in the promotion space, our work was better than most.
And then what summoned next?
So I got a call from the husband of a woman who was a client, Keith Kling Scales, who was the editor-in-chief Vibe magazine.
Vibe.
Yep. Which was, if you know hip hop and you were around the 80s, there were two publications, Vibe magazine and The Source. He was working at Vibe. He knew me through the work I did with his wife, and he called me because he got a call from Leah Burnett, Chicago ad agency, who was looking for resources to help them with Reebok client. They had Reebok. The client said, I think you might not really understand the consumer, the typically person of color, male, inner city, Chicago, New York, Miami, LA. You're in Chicago, but your brands are Maytag and Kellogg's, and maybe you need some help understanding the audience a little bit better. Mm. So they called him, and they called a bunch of people. They called him. He called me. He said, there's a project I want you to help me work on. They're going to defend this business, and they need a team. He called me because he knew the work I did. He called Mark Strachan, who's someone I didn't know that he knew, who was an account guy. He put us together. So we did a freelance project for Leah Burnett for Reebok, and that project turned into a vigilante, turned into the ad agency that we co-founded with Leah Burnett. Because on that assignment, the president or the chief creative officer of Leah Burnett was very heavily involved and saw what we did and really liked what he saw. He said, you do something we don't do. You understand a culture we don't understand. The way you look at work and the way you create things for Reebok was very different than we would ever do. I think there's something here. You can help us with our brands. You can go get your own brands. Do you want to start an agency? And we said, yeah.
I have a difficult question. And you seem to be game for them. Yeah. Suppose Leah Burnett, which did tobacco work, came in and said, we need your help in pushing menthol.
Can't do it.
You knew back then that even though that would have been.
Yeah.
Because right now, if you're following menthol cigarettes and the FDA and the Biden administration, there's this attempt to unwind 50 years of marketing targeted toward the African-American community and billboards and jazz festivals and hip-hop festivals and adjacency. And that's become one of the last frontiers of profitability for a dying industry.
Yeah. Couldn't do it. We wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it.
You knew back then you had the center of gravity to not.
Way before then. Yeah, no, that would have been a no.
But there's enough cognitive dissonance in the ad industry to say Leah Burnett, like we proudly deal with, I don't know who it was, the parent company, Philip Morris or whoever it was.
Yeah, well, Marlboro. Yeah. Leah Burnett built that Marlboro man. Well, look, somebody's going to sell it. Somebody's going to advertise
that
And
there's
brand.
That thinking that if somebody's going to do it, if I don't pounce on it, I can have my activism on the side.
Yeah.
But sneakers is one thing. But
that's a very different thing.
Yeah.
People were getting killed for sneakers, but they weren't. Sneakers weren't killing people. Yeah. I just would politely have said no. I'm not going to then march around with a flag saying how terrible. I might find a way to do that on the side. But yeah, that would have been a hard no.
It brings me to the present is I parked on the bridge here. This is a district of tobacco warehouses way back when. Mm-hmm. I believe since my cues, the Martin Agency has pushed back against tobacco. This is a major tobacco town. Altria, Philip Morris USA is based here. It's hard to avoid that money.
It's really easy.
And especially in a hurting industry where you want to get engagements.
It's easy there are some things that are easy to say no to. Mike Hughes died of lung cancer. He didn't smoke, but that's enough for us. They can find agencies. It's okay.
Yeah.
We'll take CarMax. They're also in the backyard.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I know I'm talking your head off, but I'm fascinated in this through line. In the 90s, so you're building your name, you're building your brand. Mm-hmm. You had Vigilante mm-hmm. here, which what opened the door to the Martin Agency in 2004? And Richmond, Virginia. I mean, you were summoned back to Virginia.
I was. So I was going along happily building Vigilante. We were having success. We were doing some of the best work I've done in my career.
Did you meet Oprah personally?
You know, that whole thing is weird. I was the chief creative officer, but I was not involved with that thing at all. My second partner.
Was that the Pontiac Aztec?
No, it was a Pontiac G. Jeez. Well,
that would have been a coup.
It was a G6, which also doesn't exist
anymore.
Doesn't
exist. Pontiac doesn't exist anymore.
Well, that's true, too. I'm not going to blame Oprah for that. I was happily building the agency, doing, I mean, it was a grind the first few years when it was just my partner and me and Liebernitz's support, but we were, you know, we had to build something, and we spent the first couple of years even explaining to potential clients that our concept was viable, that there's an audience out there of fairly young, this was an influencer strategy before people were talking about influencer strategies. There are groups in the U.S. in major metropolitan cities who are decidedly Black and Latina, who are influencing fashion, music, food, sports worldwide, in part because of the internet. A kid in Japan will be wearing a pair of Reeboks because he saw on MTV or somewhere, and he'll be wearing his hat backwards, and the influence is coming from the U.S. You can talk to a small group in the U.S. that's influencing a worldwide market and not spend money blanketing the America. We had to convince them that hip-hop was not a fad. We had to convince them that this audience was viable. We spent 2 years trying to make sure people understood, because my partner was a Black male, that we're not the next Black ad agency. We are talking about a group. We're also not niche, but we're talking about a group of influencers. We spent 2 years doing that. We still got people coming to us because we were Black and the new kids on the block to do work for Black Americans, which we took because we needed the revenue. But that wasn't our charge. But all that to say, I was doing the job. We were doing the job, and Mike Hughes sent me
of the Martin Agency.
Mike Hughes of the Martin Agency, the chief creative officer and president at the time, sent me an email in support of some work that he saw in the trades that we did for the United States Tennis Association. It was a time when I think Ad Age had the inside back page were ads of the week or ads of the month. And it was our work. And he just sent an email saying, I saw your work. I really liked it. I just responded, great. I knew Mike the Legend, and I think I'd met him at an event once. And what I've always said when I met Mike was he was one of the few heads of agencies that when I met and he said, how are you? That he really was asking me, and that he shook my hand and he looked at me and he spoke to me. And I said, nobody knows who I am. But Mike made it a point to say hello and made me feel like, oh, maybe I'm part of this industry after all.
Where was that fateful lunch, that fateful interview, New York, Richmond?
We exchanged emails, and he said, next time you're in the city, why don't we have lunch? We met in Grand Central Station and had lunch, maybe the Oyster Bar. One of the restaurants.
Yeah,
and I don't think it was the Oyster Bar, but it was one of the restaurants in Grand Central.
In the concourse, yeah.
Yeah. We just talked. And I thought we were just talking. And at the end, he said, what would it take to get you to come to Martin? I don't know. I'm not looking to go anywhere. I'm building an agency. I haven't thought about it. He said, well, think about it. So I left, and I think he caught me in a weak moment. Because I had just said the day before that, man, I'm spending a lot of time commuting from Connecticut to New York because our agency was in Soho. My kids are high school approaching. The past few years, I haven't seen them a lot, not as much as I want to because we're building this agency. I'm not home a bunch. I'm traveling. It costs a lot of money to live here.
Yeah.
All those things converged the day before I met Mike, which gave me gave me pause. I started thinking, well, maybe this is a chance to get actually into the industry for the first time. I felt Vigilante was an ad agency, but not in the industry, although we made a mark. So I thought about it, and we met again, and this time he brought John Adams, who was the CEO
professorial
at the time.
John Adams.
So John Adams and Mike Hughes had a lunch with me, and I had a piece of paper with the answer to his question. I said, I'm going to do the classic slide a piece of paper over with the answer, what'll it take to get me to come to Martin, and see what happens. And I slid the paper over, and he looked at it, and then he just kind of said, okay. And I was like, damn,
now it forces the...
Yeah, and it wasn't high enough, obviously, because nobody blinked.
Did you suspect you were going to come back to Virginia?
No. My wife didn't suspect it either. So you were going where?
There was some innovative stuff. There was some innovative stuff back then. I remember with the famous Geico Caveman, they had a thing where you could... I was working with Stuart Elliott at the New York Times, mm-hmm. and it was a fascinating thing on the web browsers. Do you remember this? You could go into the caveman's house.
Yes.
And you could knock on his shower door and everything. It was very ahead of its time. And others were doing, I think, the dancing chicken with Burger King and others. The subversive chicken.
Yeah.
This place had been known, the one that took risks, that was proudly funky. It was in Richmond, Virginia. You always had to try harder because so many of your clients had to take two flights to get here.
Yeah, that's true. Right? The Spung Monkeys for Quiznos. We took a lot of really weird risks. To shorten the story, because it's a long story, to shorten it, obviously I said yes at some point and made a trek here, brought my family kicking and screaming. My wife loves it now. My kids, they're fine. But as soon as they graduated college, they went back to the Northeast. But yeah, that's how I got here. It was a moment in time. Mike just got me at a weak point.
And
in my
zero
life.
Expectation in that 15 years you would be chief content officer and then CEO. In less than 20 years.
Chief creative officer and then CEO. I don't even plan the week ahead.
Likewise.
I don't have, I hated the 1 year, 3 year, 5 year plan. I don't know. I know how I feel right now and we'll see how I feel tomorrow. I'll just put my head down and do the best job I can and hope that's enough. It's not always. It worked out here. May not have worked out somewhere else.
So in the few minutes we have left, I'm going to put you on the spot because you seem to be game for these things.
I know. You can ask me anything. I don't care.
The last thing, it's an AMA with Danny Robinson. We mentioned the Oprah stunt and you get a car. You get a car. And who played her on SNL?
Maya Rudolph.
And who has a Prince cover band?
Maya Rudolph.
We need to bring her to Richmond. I want to tell the story of Maya Rudolph, everything she went through, Minnie Riperton's daughter, rooming with Gwyneth Paltrow, the SNL times. I mean, this is a fascinating person.
She's amazing.
Eminem. She's been in Drunk History playing Griselda Blanco. I'm a massive fan. And this is one of those people who's married to P.T. Anderson, who's Hollywood royalty, Oscar winning everything. This is a stunt like that Dave Grohl thing that happened here 10 years ago. I'm sure if we put our heads together, you as the Prince super fan, I did a full disclosure with her on stage. TMA or Danny acting as Danny welcomes her, followed by her Prince cover band concert. Do you think if we put our heads together, we can make that happen?
I would love to make that happen.
Use your illusion, sir. You've made a lot happen here at the Martin Agency. Danny Robinson, CEO of the great ad agency, the Martin Agency, where my show started back in May of 2014. It's a very different world, but I'm glad that we finally met, sir.
This has been a pleasure. Let's do it again in 2027.
Actually, a lot sooner than that. I mean, I only met you having moved here 12 years ago, but that's neither here nor there. Thank you. You're always welcome on the show.
Thank you very much.
Full disclosure, special thanks this week to Neil Davis, chief engineer at Superjoy, and as always, Claire Morgan and Case Graham at Notterly. Note that while we often cut for broadcast length, the entirety of every episode, every conversation is available on podcast, on NPR, Apple, Spotify, all the podcatchers. The link, please subscribe, is foldyradio.com. Again, foldyradio.com. They are all there. Follow along on all the socials that handle Foldy Radio. And a shout out to our listeners on NPR member station Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news resource. Message me if you'd like to carry Full Disclosure on your air. My DMs are always open. And catch me every week on NPR's Here and Now. I'm Robin Farzad. Thank you for listening and back with you next week.